When we share someone's story here on the Diaries, the episode might end, but their story doesn't. So many of the people we've talked to, they've gone on to do incredible things. They have epic adventures and make significant impacts in our community. Over on Diaries Plus, we're catching up with some of our former guests to see what they've been up to. I recently sat down with Connor Ryan, a Lakota professional skier from our Sacred Slopes episode, who's been knocking out groundbreaking projects ever since the episode aired. It's really incredible. We had a great discussion about the impacts he's made, what keeps his fire burning, and taking ski lessons as a pro skier. Here's a snippet of the conversation.
All the source of joy that I use to fill my cup to be out in the world doing positive things comes from my relationship to the outdoors. And so I really focused on like, wow, like there's so much power if I can give one person the relationship to the outdoors that I have through skiing. And maybe that will have as profound of an effect on them as it's had on me.
To listen to the full episode, use the link in the show notes to subscribe to Diaries Plus today. Yeah, you get more shows, but you also have a peace of mind of powering what's out there right now, keeping us moving forward, keeping this community together. So thank you for everyone who supported and everyone who's going to support. We appreciate it. All right, Lauren, happy Monday.
It's Super Monday.
Super Monday today. You know, maybe escapism is high at my list right now, but if someone offered you a chance to go colonize Mars, would you take it? I mean, it's sort of, I know that elevated up quickly, but for real, like, you know, say there was a mission to Mars, would you want to go do that?
Oh, that's a serious question. Honestly, my initial instinct is no.
Okay.
Like, I'm kind of curious, maybe for a day, you know, if I could pop in and check it out.
That's how I feel about Burning Man.
Yeah. Dude, exactly. Yeah, but like for more than, like if I really had to commit, you know, like if it was a one-way ticket or something like that, I feel like the isolation of it just makes my gut reaction is no, I don't want to go to Mars. Do you?
So I think there was a certain point in my life and for like many years where I think, you know, if they magically had needed some sort of, you know, well, one, that was actually happening. And then, you know, they needed someone who had serious podcasting skills as part of that crack team. Yeah, I think that there would have been a period about that I would have been into that. There's something so powerful about that image, that idea of a remote outpost in a harsh environment. Even that sense, like, it's not that dissimilar from trying to get to the top of some of the world's highest peaks, you know? They're just places that aren't meant for humans. And to want to go there is one of the most human things about it. And, I mean, there's dune buggies and spacesuits and seeing places that few other people will ever experience and existing in an environment that is decidedly out to kill you. And all of it in a way is like being done for science or humanity. And I don't know, there's just something romantic about that, that at a certain point, yeah, I might have been like, sign me up and all my podcasting skills.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely get that part. I think if I could get over feeling scared about it, I mean, it's a pretty human thing, I think. I mean, that's why we see it over and over again for so long, right? In movies and books and on TV shows, it feels like every year there's like a new big thing about space and the way that just being so far out there really captures our imagination.
Lauren, what if I told you that that opportunity exists right here on Earth and they're accepting applications and you do not have to be a rocket scientist?
I don't know. This still sounds maybe terrible to me, but I'm listening. I'm listening.
Okay. Well, welcome to the South Pole. The Amundsen Scott South Pole Station. The scientific research base sits atop 9,000 feet of ice. It sits in eternal, profound darkness for half the year. In the winter, blizzards rake this outpost and temperatures can drop to negative 100 degrees. Its existence is made possible only by an ever-shifting ice road weaving through the ice cap's maze of crevasses, an umbilical cord of food and fuel. Every year, once the winter's blizzards have eased, a small team needs to reconnect the South Pole Station to McMurdo Base, 1,000 miles away. They got to find the best path through the ice fields as a caravan of giant tractor-like snowcats. It's a journey that takes a month, and everything they need to exist and function must be dragged behind.
And this team, they've got to have someone in charge, right? Someone to keep everyone alive, make the mission successful. And this person would have to be really badass. They'd have to be seasoned and calm, tough, super resilient, and capable of a job that only a few people on this planet, I think, are capable of. I mean, in essence, they would need to be Natalie Brechtel. So today, we present The Only Way Out Is Through, a story about sticking with it, even in one of the harshest places on Earth.
I'm Fitzcohall.
I'm Lauren Delaney Miller.
You're listening to The Dirtbag Diaries.
The temperature sounded really cold, but inherently, as a Southern California girl, was like, I'm sure that that's actually just being listed in Celsius, and it's not actually that cold in Fahrenheit. And it wasn't until I was pretty much on the plane arriving that I realized it was definitely Fahrenheit, and it's definitely just really, really, really cold. Like, so cold I couldn't begin to comprehend it, because you basically arrive and it's negative 40 or so, which is actually the same in both, ironically. But just like, that's not a temperature I'd ever encountered. I mean, to get to zero seemed cold. So I like walk off the plane and everything just freezes on your face.
Where are you from? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Southern California, kind of beach town and hanging out in the deserts.
So a little bit different then.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very unprepared for the cold. I went to university at UC Santa Barbara. I did zero things that would acclimatize me to being in the cold whatsoever. Yeah.
Natalie Brechtel has spent 10 seasons working in one of the coldest places on Earth, Antarctica. Even after so many years, she's still surprised at the direction her life has taken her.
My teachers in second grade told my parents I was a kinetic learner because I couldn't stop moving in my chair. And I was put into gymnastics so I could run my energy out 4 hours a day. And if I skipped a day, I'd bounce off the walls.
As it does for many folks, Natalie's need to move eventually led her to the outdoors.
After university was when I finally hit the climbing bug, and that was doing a long multi-pitch and realizing that that particular style of alpine climbing is what I gravitate towards. And after that, I kind of went full bore into climbing.
She soon began guiding for her school's outdoor program in everything from backpacking and climbing to sea kayaking and canoeing. 6 months after graduating, she moved to New Zealand with the hopes of finding even bigger adventures.
I worked there doing some guiding on the South Island, and I kept running into people from the U.S., and every time I'd ask what they were doing there, they were like, oh, well, we work in Antarctica.
A seed was planted in Natalie's head. Antarctica sounded wild, beautiful, rugged, and remote. Everything she'd fallen in love with during her travels around the world, but on a more extreme scale than she'd ever experienced before.
But then I moved back to the U.S. and worked full-time at the university running the outdoor program, and 5 years had passed, and I became so obsessed with the idea of just getting to go somewhere that most people don't go.
After 5 years back in Southern California, she started looking for ways to finally make it happen. It seemed like there were only a few jobs that would make use of her wide array of outdoor skills, and she quickly learned that those were really competitive.
It can be hard to get a job down there when you don't have any connections.
Natalie was told that she'd likely need to lower her standards and resort to grunt work to get her foot in the door. Luckily, she has a penchant for manual labor, and she ended up interviewing for two different positions, and she decided to take whichever job offer came first.
I got the offer for the South Pole job, the official offer first, to just work one season is what I thought.
In October, she'd be heading to Antarctica for the 2011-2012 Austral summer season. And it started back where the idea had been planted, New Zealand.
The transition from New Zealand is pretty dramatic because it is green and humid and moist. And then you get into this plane. And then actually, before you ever get to the continent, what you'll start to see are floating pack ice pieces, like just broken away white chunks. So if you have a lucky day that is clear and a window to look out, you see some of the most spectacular spires of white clawed mountains with just these massive arêtes. And I mean, just the most stunning lines. And then as you get into the sound, you also get these huge glacial tongues that will come and be floating out into the middle of the ocean, just massive glaciers. So if you have a lucky day, you get to see all of that. If it's an unlucky day, it's just white. Then you land in white.
The giant military plane landed at McMurdo Station, the largest base in the U.S. Antarctic program. Around 1,000 people live at the station during the summer months, and it's like a small town, with bunkhouses, social and gathering spaces, multiple workout facilities, and even nearby hiking trails. But this is not where Natalie would be spending her season.
McMurdo Station is close to what we call the Dry Valleys, which is one of the only dry places on the continent where it like fully melts out from snow and even begins to have water channels that form and run. And those are all still connected into the Trans-Antarctic that are these massive mountain fields. And so it's actually really dramatic scenery when it's available to see. And so you fly into that and you're like, oh, McMurdo looks okay. And then you get to the South Pole and it is actually just flat and white, just to the horizon line, 360 degrees around you.
The South Pole station is rugged and isolated, 1,000 miles from McMurdo. Natalie and around 200 other people would spend 5 months there, maintaining the infrastructure needed to support the scientists conducting research at the station. There was a lot Natalie was unsure about, but surprisingly, cold wasn't one of them.
I'd certainly still been up in the mountains and doing things in the cold within the California mountain range, and so naively that felt like enough qualifications to be able to be in the cold.
But this was different.
It is one of the coldest, driest places on Earth. And that dryness is so intense, it feels like water is just coming out of your hands and your body. Like you cannot drink enough water. Your hands start to crack, your lips start to crack. There's general fatigue as you work to try to balance that out. And the altitude itself changes really dramatically day by day. So if a pressure system moves through, you might go to bed at 9,300 feet and wake up at 11,000 feet.
There's less available oxygen at higher altitudes, but this is slightly more dramatic at the poles. Because of the spinning of the globe, the poles have thinner atmosphere, which means there's less oxygen available per breath. So while the actual altitude didn't change, on days with low pressure, it would feel like being much higher in elevation. As the reality of where she'd be spending the next 4 months started to set in, so too was the reality of her work. She had been hired as one of 15 general assistants assigned to the South Pole, and their preseason training had told them to expect to be outside in the cold, shoveling lots of snow, or helping with construction and carpentry.
I remember being interviewed, and there were a lot of questions about things I had done to my vehicle. So I remember answering things like, well, I had this starter that I would bang, and then it would start, and I replaced the brake pads, and I had like done some oil changes. And those don't, to me, like that does not maketh a diesel mechanic. But apparently, that was a lot more than other people had had. And then I get into the station and immediately am kind of confronted with these mechanics that are calling my name and tell me that I've actually been selected to just work with diesel mechanics and do like grease monkey work in the heavy machine shop. And so I was instantly like overwhelmed because I had completely different concepts of my time and space and of temperature and I would say that that first journey was jarring.
Natalie worked with a small crew of men in their 40s in the vehicle maintenance facility. Those were her direct coworkers, but she also interacted most days with the utility technicians, all men, the electricians, all men, the welders, all men, and the power plant operators, all men. You get the picture. Natalie described it as a sea of men.
I wasn't the only one who was shocked that I became a mechanics helper. I think that they were not, like their first impression looking me up and down, which they fully did when they met me, was like, this is who we're dealing with?
Natalie told me that her coworkers would frequently make sexual jokes, stare at her, and openly talk about their desires with her to one another. But it wasn't just uncomfortable. They were also making her workplace unsafe.
They made an effort to make things as difficult as possible for me. And that included putting me in places like there's this battery acid room where we had stored sulfuric acid and it was leaking inappropriately.
When Natalie asked for protective equipment, her coworkers wouldn't give it to her.
I remember early on going into this room and trying to do work and coming down with a headache and feeling really uncomfortable and sick. And I had to go to medical and the doctor was like, that's not appropriate. This room isn't being ventilated properly. You shouldn't go in there. And they told my supervisor, but nothing was done. And they actually made a point after that to try to find jobs for me to do in there as much as possible. About a month in, we had someone who rotated in as another helper that showed up front, and he was a big strapping guy, and he showed up and had to go do work in that battery acid room. And I, that day, was working with electricians in the ice tunnels, which was like 1,000 times more fun to me because they were really nice. Even though I had to stand, it was negative 60 in the ice tunnels, and I just sit there and hold metal and stay still, and it was really cold. But I remember coming back from that day, and they said that guy got sick and that the room wasn't safe anymore and it was shut down. But when I had been sick a month earlier, they just absolutely dismissed it. And so it was just kind of this pervasive, inappropriate treatment and behavior.
Natalie had set out for Antarctica thinking that extreme weather would be the thing that put her in danger. But she quickly began to realize that it was actually the people that made her feel unsafe. The U.S. Antarctic program generally, and the South Pole Station specifically, are really male-dominated spaces. In Natalie's first year, fewer than 25% of the people at the South Pole were women. Some of this is because of how many trade workers there are, fields that are distinctly male-dominated across the U.S. But Natalie was used to male-dominated spaces like mountain guiding and climbing. Here, the dynamics seemed intensified.
Very quickly, you realize that in a community that small, the South Pole Station, we were high population that year, so we were close to 200 people. And you start to realize that, you know, you're eating three meals a day in the same spot, you're walking through the same hallways, you really have very little separation. I was out in what we called summer camp, which is a quarter mile away from the main station. You walk out on the snow, and then there's these large archways that covered with tarps, and between those tarps, they've draped blankets inside the interior, like a military bunkhouse style, and those blankets between different spaces are the walls between you and your neighbor.
Whether it was sleeping, working, or eating, Natalie was always around other people. She worked 9 hours a day, 6 days a week, and in her limited free time, it was hard to find space to herself. And because there's no separation between work life and personal life, Natalie started to notice that interpersonal lines were being blurred.
And I realized a few weeks in, when I started feeling that pressure of getting a lot more attention than I had expected, and I kind of did the numbers and was like, there's less than 10 single women on station right now, and I'm one of them. I actually had to learn to acknowledge less people and say less highs because of how it got misinterpreted. Because the next step is that then they see you out on an evening, and if they, you know, feel like it, they walk up and they grab me by my back and touch me in some way that has been uninvited.
And while her coworkers hazed her at work, other men on the base started to invade her coveted free time.
I mean, I remember some of those scientists and professors that invited me over New Year's. One of them asked me to dance and then just was like, you're just so adorable and so cute and so tiny, and just made all these comments. And I, having left the university setting as an employee, thought to myself, you could never talk to your grad students this way. Like, you could never talk to your coworkers this way when you were back home at the university. But somehow here, it feels okay to do that.
There's a term Natalie used to describe life in Antarctica, the gray zone. She explained to me that the tight quarters and limited ability to go outside added to the intensity of working, living, and socializing all with the same people. Many people around her were coupling up. But for Natalie, this attention was unwanted, and it only increased as time wore on.
I wish that had been the end of it, but on top of that, I was also reaching a point where I was getting stalked by someone. And the main messaging there is like, do your best to get along with everybody else. Don't cause problems.
Even though Natalie desperately wanted some time to herself, she became afraid of being alone.
There were multiple situations in which I felt that my space was being invaded, in particular with the person who was stalking me. And it was kind of something to keep an eye out as far as being in a room by myself and getting followed into it and needing to like have other people around to feel safe, which is ironic because the other aspect of the problem is like there's almost no space by yourself.
Life at the South Pole was hard in so many ways. And yet, the part of her that had sought out the adventure in the first place was thrilled.
Let's reframe. First season in Antarctica, totally naive, didn't realize how cold it was gonna be, didn't really realize how hard the work was going to be or what that social dynamic was. But when I came down there, I was so enamored to be able to stand at the actual South Pole and know that I was seeing it and that I could from there look any direction and it's north.
Soon, Natalie got a glimpse into another part of Antarctic life.
Partway through the season, we get this traverse team that arrives from McMurdo, the main station, and they deliver a huge amount of fuel to help the South Pole station run. And they've driven overland up the Trans-Ar into Antarctic and arrived at station. And I remember seeing things like that and just imagining how wild and amazing it would be to be a part of that and to just have those types of experiences.
The South Pole Traverse. Natalie and her coworkers had flown to the South Pole station at the start of the season, but they relied on the Traverse team coming overland from McMurdo to resupply them. But in Antarctica, there isn't just a road to drive on. So each year, the Traverse team, in giant tractors, has to pioneer the route around truck-swallowing crevasses and through mind-numbing whiteouts. And that seemed like the type of adventure Natalie had envisioned.
What happened to me was I was meeting some of the most amazing people and seeing this experience, but it was a little bit like through a glass wall because it wasn't the experience that I was having. And there were multiple things I saw that first season as far as the potential for work and the potential for community and the potential for exploration.
A big part of that was because, despite all the hell she was enduring, she did build a small community.
I met lots of amazing people, but one person in particular, we just hit it off right away. It's the type of thing where you're, every time you see each other from across the room, you're smiling and you're always making the choice to sit next to each other or talk and hang out and always laughing and having a great time.
After their season ended, Natalie and Jesse met back up in the States.
Pretty much right away began to date and just had a lovely experience of being able to share in each other's lives and start immediately going on little adventures. He lived in Colorado and I was in California, so we'd kind of travel to meet up. And that was pretty incredible. In many ways, he's the love of my life, or was one love of my life. But unfortunately, our adventurous spirit did lead us to a situation in which we took a trip into the mountains in Colorado and had an accident, and he passed.
On a canoe trip in the mountains of Colorado, Jesse and Natalie got caught in high winds. Their boat overturned, and while Natalie was able to swim to shore, Jesse wasn't. Despite all of her work in guiding and leading trips just like this one, she hadn't been able to save him. And her world unraveled.
It was a pretty hard year for me because I left with this huge kind of open heart for the adventure of being down there. And then that season wasn't really very enjoyable. If anything, it was kind of traumatic. And then I got one really amazing gem out of that, which was this person that I fell in love with. And then that person, unfortunately, just left this world too quickly, and I lost that as well, all within a 6-month period.
A summer passed in somewhat of a haze. Natalie realized that winter was on the horizon again. She and Jesse had planned to go back to the South Pole together, but she wasn't sure if she could go alone.
I don't think people expected that I would go back to the place where all of that had been generated and put myself back into that kind of vulnerable position and try again to go down there.
Part of her wanted to just walk away, but somewhere inside her, she knew she wasn't finished. The only way out, she realized, was through.
I think I was able to compartmentalize my personal experience at the moment to what the potential was. And ultimately, to the shock of everyone in my life, I did go back for a second season. And one of the main reasons I did was actually because the first season was so bad that I felt like these personalities had crowded out the experience that I sought, and I wasn't going to let that be the end of the story. I knew that I needed to reclaim something I'd looked forward to for so many years and that there was so much potential in, and give it at least another solid go and not let those people let that be the experience that I walked away with instead. And so I did go back again.
After the break, Natalie heads back to Antarctica. Stay tuned.
Calling all business owners out there.
Yeah, I'm talking to you. Our planet needs businesses to be better. Newsflash, right? There's a way we do that. One of the moments in our journey as a company that Becca and I are most proud of is the day we joined 1% for the Planet 14 years ago. We know we have an impact. It's undeniable, right? It's not someone else's problem. It's our problem. And we wanted to become a part of a global network of individuals, businesses, and environmental not-for-profits driving real impact. So every year there's a day where we sit down and we plan our giving. It starts with a donation, but we've been able to bolster that with in-kind donations. There's all sorts of ways to do this. Other companies give employee volunteer time, so there's a solution that's right for you. The biggest thing is it connects us with others who care and organizations going to bat for the values we believe in. And it makes us feel part of something bigger than our small company. So if you're a business owner, big or small, publicly traded or not, there's room for you in this movement. Visit 1percentfortheplanet.org/dirtbagdiaries for more information. Be a part of this. We may have more than one career, but there is only one planet. 1% for the planet.
With Jesse, Natalie had been able to imagine building a life and career in Antarctica. And after he died, she felt compelled to see that vision through.
The path for grieving is so different for everybody, but for me, I needed to turn that grief into actions. I'm spiritual, but I don't have a particular religious practice, but I have this vision of, like, if Jesse could look down and see what was going on, I know that he would want to know that I was still doing the things that I was excited about and that his accident didn't ruin that opportunity, that I didn't just like kind of clam up and disappear. I didn't want to go back to the South Pole because of the experience I had and because of the layouts of that particular station. I felt like there was no escaping. And so I made the choice to go to McMurdo.
With a population of closer to 1,000 people, Natalie hoped she would feel safer at McMurdo than she had at the South Pole.
And I went to a work department that was more in alignment with what I had originally thought, which is doing really physical things outside. And that particular department did a really good job of trying to hire a closer to 50-50 ratio of men to women. And it was a really strong workplace to get into, to feel like I could be a part of the community I had seen and hadn't yet experienced. I mean, I had an amazing time. I finally made friends. I joined the community that I had thought I wanted to do. And I definitely fell in love with the place more.
After that season, Natalie kept going back, year after year after year. She had a number of jobs, working in the fuels department, field camps, and mostly as a mountaineer.
And then I actually ended up spending a winter where I worked in fuels and helped run that department for the winter. So I stayed on the continent for 14 months straight. And that culminated 5 seasons of work. And after that, 14 months and an entire winter and all that darkness where most people are like desperate to leave and can't wait to get off, I actually didn't want to leave. And this inner voice inside my head that had my own self-preservation in mind was like, Natalie, you need to take a break.
She took 2 years off, but before long, the call of the ice wouldn't quiet down. So back she went.
And so when I started back up, I went more in that direction of the jobs I had originally always wanted, which was field safety and essentially providing the technical support for the scientists.
In the Northern Hemisphere summers, Natalie was back in the U.S., guiding and leading wilderness medicine courses. Working to keep others safe made Natalie realize how much she had lost the ability to feel safe herself, from the harassment she faced during her first season to the loss of her partner months later. But a few years in, she started being able to bring these skills back to Antarctica, working with the McMurdo search and rescue team and teaching scientists glacier travel skills. And then, after her 9th season, Natalie was asked to be the safety lead for the traverse to the South Pole.
Those 10 seasons earlier, it was such an impossible idea that I would have put it truly up in the clouds as just dreaming. And by the time that job came around, it was something that just like came together and was put in my lap like without any hesitation. And I actually hadn't been back to the South Pole since I had left that first season and then left with this person and lost them. And I was on a path of seeking, you know, slowly how to put certain aspects of my grieving process to rest, because I've basically tried to tick off every dream that we had together. And it also culminated one of my final dreams that I had had from that first season. And so it just felt really amazing.
The traverse began to feel like an exit exam for Natalie, a final test of her own relationship to risk and safety.
I just don't even know if I could describe just how overwhelming it is to be given that opportunity to reface all of that again and from a new perspective and a totally different position, and allow for that level of kind of like healing and catharsis to show that I've arrived somewhere.
So in September of 2022, 10 years after she first boarded a flight to Antarctica, Natalie got on a plane in New Zealand and headed south. At the beginning of the austral summer, the crew who will be stationed at the South Pole fly in, just like Natalie had in her first season. But at some point, they need to be restocked with supplies, especially fuel. It's heavy and inefficient to fly that much weight the 1,000 miles from McMurdo to the South Pole. Flights down there are really unreliable, and they often cancel due to weather and mechanical challenges in the extreme cold. That is where the Traverse team comes in. Multiple groups will travel from McMurdo to the South Pole each season, following roughly the same route from previous years, across ice shelves and many glaciers. And these glaciers are moving, and so the first team of the season needs to travel slowly, plotting the exact route that will take them safely through changing crevassed areas.
The earth is moving essentially underneath you, and the way that we make a route be more visible is the tracks of the tractor. Like, the next trip will have a much easier time knowing how to make a straight line between flags because they can see all the tracks of these 10 tractors rolling over the snow. Whereas the very first person who shows up, it's been a whole winter, it's now stormed all winter long, all of those tracks are mostly filled in.
Of course, the traverse isn't happening on foot. Natalie would lead, navigating in a small tractor similar to those used to groom snow at ski resorts, followed by 8 bigger tractors. One was dragging everything the traverse team would need to survive their trip, shipping containers being used for sleeping and cooking, plus a generator, food, and a tool shed. Another was towing a container of scientific equipment needed at the base. And then 6 were towing giant bladders filled with fuel. As the safety coordinator for the traverse, Natalie had 2 main responsibilities. 1, use ground-penetrating radar to look for crevasses. Because the traverse team is traveling in heavy equipment with incredibly heavy loads, Natalie's looking for snow bridges that would break under the load and crevasses that are wide enough to risk falling into.
Anyone who's on a tractor, if they have to step off their tractor, has to be attached to a rope attached to the tractor.
Which brings us to Natalie's second responsibility, crevasse rescue and glacier safety. Natalie taught her 9 team members as much crevasse rescue as she could. She went over safety protocols and began working to earn the trust of her colleagues. As the only woman on the crew, she knew it might be tough. After a scant 10 days to prepare and train, their departure day arrived.
You have to start the tractors by 6:30 in the morning so that the engines can start to warm up. And an important but random detail is you also should ideally poop by 6:30 in the morning because all of our waste products have to be contained. And so all of our urine goes into 55-gallon drums and all of our poop is meant to be burnt, but we have to put the generator off. And so you have to get poop in time to be able to be deposited so that it can also appropriately and thoroughly be burned, or bad things start to happen with the wind direction. All that has to happen by 6:30 in the morning. And then we have morning meeting at 7, and then we're on the road within 15 minutes or less. And so this driving starts by 7:15, let's say. You get a 15-minute break at 10 o'clock. This is very regimented, by the way, like down to the minute.
There's a lot of jostling, and the crew takes a quick break to make sure nothing has bounced loose or that the ratchet straps haven't worn through anything.
Then you drive till noon. We have an hour lunch break. You drive till 3, you get another 15-minute load check, and then you drive all the way till 5:45.
The tractor caravan is spread out over a quarter mile, so it takes a few minutes for everyone to gather up.
And then at that point, because you've been driving all day long, you actually need to refuel all the tractors. So all the fuel we're dragging, we're also using to supply the energy to keep us moving forward. And that refueling goes from 5:45 till about 7 o'clock at night to just get all of the tractors topped off. One person peels off and is working on making dinner. Everyone else is fueling equipment and just chipping ice away from everything, because any of like the ice filled up throughout the day can also freeze everything into place and damage the equipment. At 7 o'clock, you have dinner. Then we get dishes done and you're pretty much done with your day at 8 p.m. And then you get that whatever you want to do from 8 p.m. till you're tired enough to go to sleep. There is a separate space for sleeping that is just that kind of single wide trailer with one long hallway and multiple rooms divided into two bunk beds. And so everyone has a roommate, including me. And so there's no ability necessarily to guarantee that private space.
And then they wake up and do it all over again, and again, and again. The route is about the distance from Los Angeles to Denver, or New York to Orlando. In a car going highway speeds, you could get to and from those cities in one long day of driving. But the Traverse team will average only 5 miles per hour, meaning it will take them almost a month to complete the Traverse. And that's just one way.
But there was one element that was missing in this traverse, which is that we were not moving under human-based power. And I underestimated how challenging that is, because when you are out there doing hard things, but physically exerting yourself, I think you're also allowing some amount of release of that stress of the hard thing and fatigue of that stress of the hard thing that's full-bodied. You know, you may actually be really engaged mentally in managing your risk, but you're also engaged physically. And this was not. You're sitting and you're driving and you're staring at screens or staring out a window, but it looks like a computer screen of just white. And very quickly, within a couple days of those long hours of driving, you hit 5 p.m. and you just start counting down the clock. Like, I cannot wait till it's 5:45.
As always, there wasn't a lot of alone time. But after 10 seasons in Antarctica, Natalie had found ways to deal. Noise-canceling headphones helped, as did finding a better way to balance interpersonal dynamics.
A strategy that I have, that I adopted very early on, is a little bit of balancing out, finding a balance of being able to be with all of these men a little bit like their little sister or older sister or someone in their family that has a dynamic where they're totally included and I'm allowed to still be a woman, but I'm not being sexualized. Mm-hmm. And that is a really hard thing to navigate. And I don't think anyone who hasn't had to do it appreciates how much mental space and energy that takes, because one thing I wasn't willing to do was to pretend to be a man or to like cover myself up in some way that wasn't ever going to be effective anyway. Like, there was no amount of like ungendering myself I could do.
Managing conflict between the team was important, but so was finding ways to deal with things that were going on inside her own head.
At one point, we were driving over 400 miles without turning left or right. And so it's days and days and days of just trying to drive straight, and it turns flat white and you lose sight of the mountains. And that very quickly overwhelmed me, and I was I realized I needed to create strategies. I was like, I have to do something that makes these days feel different. So every 15-minute break, I'm working out. But on Sundays, I'm only doing yoga outside the tractor. And on Sundays, I'm skipping breakfast and I'm fasting. And I'm like going to, you know, sleep in that day instead of forcing myself to be up early and accomplish things. And I just had to do that so that I could mark the change of the day because there were no days off on Traverse.
At first, Natalie thought that having an uneventful day was good. It meant that everything went smoothly. But soon, she began to crave days with a little more action, just to break up the monotony.
When there's nothing going on, you start, like, getting in your own head. And initially, that might be good. Like, you start processing, and there's plenty of things for me to process, right? You're like, great, I'm thinking through this, I'm putting some things to closure, and that's great. But you begin to run out of things, and then you start going into, like, spaces in your brain that are, like, dusty closets that you probably didn't ever need to go back to, but you're going to open that door anyway because you have nothing else to do with your thought process.
As the team passed waypoint after waypoint, Natalie could feel her heart opening again. A decade had passed since she'd been to the South Pole, and she wasn't sure what it would feel like to be back. She was ready to find out, but she wasn't sure how much time she would have there. She was scheduled to fly back to McMurdo, not drive, and when the team set out, she knew there was a chance she'd have to leave the same day that she arrived.
And that was challenging for me because I have this history that's so loaded. I just wanted a little bit of time to walk these halls and kind of like say hello to the ghosts there. And when that was going to be taken away, just personally, I was feeling sad. And to be honest, the people on the Traverse didn't know this. That particular burden that I took on the Traverse was just mine to carry.
As the team approached the South Pole, they started to see markers of human life. Fuel drums and equipment caches let them know they were close, and Natalie learned that she would be able to spend the night at the station.
And the South Pole station people are so excited. Like, there'd been some that have gone and driven tractors and kind of packed the route for us to make it easier driving, and like people like drove out to greet us and were kind of like chariting us into station because everyone's just so excited.
It felt like a lifetime ago that she was part of the receiving crowd, gawking in awe at the Traverse team. And now, there she was, on the other side.
So I got a day and a half of time, and I felt like I could have used more at the moment, and I felt rushed, but in reality, there was nothing else to accomplish except for just setting foot in that door again and owning that space in the way that I did, and knowing when I take the step back, how much work and how much I've accomplished to get there.
Natalie returned to McMurdo, and then the next day, she was on her way home. This time, she didn't know if she would ever be back.
I think being in Antarctica has filled my life with many moments that make me think that I'm in a movie. Like, I might have looked out the window and slightly cried and then been like, I don't know when I'm gonna be back. And I've just had moments in on that Traverse that it's like, am I in some bizarre comedy right now? Like, who does this? And it's one of the things that's so special about the place. It's the things that keep you addicted and you want to come back because you begin to reappreciate and crave a life that's lived so vividly and so strongly that you could take little snippets and be like, this could be a scene. Like this incident where there's orcas swimming around me and they're looking me in the eye and they're only 15 feet away and the sea ice is broken out. And there's penguins and they're running around and they're like, you know, shedding feathers and looking adorable and they run up to you and you just sit there and look at them. Or a seal and a seal baby. There's, you know, flying up and getting to do like a training on an active volcano with glaciated terrain around you and this blooming volcano, just such unreal experiences that I've gotten over those 10 years. And yeah, I live movies in my head all the time with that I'll get to share for the rest of my life with myself and any willing person who will listen to me talk about it.
Reflecting on her 10 seasons in Antarctica, the question of what it means to feel safe looms large. From that first season, when her sense of safety was taken away, to her last season, when she was responsible for keeping her whole team safe, it's been quite the journey.
I think it is so unexpected that I would have been in the situations that I am in. I mean, if you stay focused on the little steps, it makes perfect sense. Like, I can explain how each step led to another, but in the big picture, there's no way I could have predicted that this is the turn my life would have made. I just think I have inherently been a little bit of a more shy and nervous and conservative person that didn't think of myself necessarily as an adventurer. And so that is clearly not how I've chosen to live my life. I've chosen to instead follow the inspirations despite the fears and the insecurities and the shyness.
Through it all, Natalie has learned the value of leaning into discomfort. And even though her time in Antarctica has come to a close, the skills and confidence she's gained there will stay with her.
I've faced a fear and then I've stepped past it. And each time I have been exponentially rewarded by choosing to engage that fear and come out of it feeling not only just less fear, but having really amazing experiences that have actually been really, really positive by just leaning into that discomfort a little bit more and listening to the parts that actually matter and ignoring all the parts that are just like, well, that's going to be hard and uncomfortable and what ifs. And instead just being like, I actually believe in myself a little bit more, just a little bit more that I can manage that next step. And that has been a really valuable skill that will translate and continue to be used in life for me.
Thank you, Natalie, for sharing your story. Our stories come from friends, from friends of friends, and from you, our community. If you have a compelling idea for a guest or a story lead, please give us a shout. You can use the submission form on our website, dirtbagdiaries.com. If you've got questions for music, we've also got answers on our website. Today's music is from Tiger in the Sky, Sunshapes, Boss Fight, Dear Nora, and David Swenson. The tracks are courtesy of the Artists Track Club or Free Music Archive. Jacob Bain and Nice Koto composed our theme song. Like I said, check it out on our website. This episode was produced by Lauren Delaney Miller with additional production help from Ashley Langholtz and Becca Cahal. Illustration by Walker Cahal. Becca Cahal is our executive producer. I'm Fitz Cahal, and you've been listening to The Dirtbag Diaries. Thanks for tuning in.